is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Good afternoon. I want to welcome on behalf of the court CTSO organizations, career and technical student organizations. We're delighted to have you with us. Would you all stand up, please, so we can see you? Very good. Are you from all over the state? Under the umbrella career and technical student organizations? Well, good. And how long will you be in Madison? Pardon me?
Just today.
Just today? Well, good. Thank you for coming. Does somebody want to say something?
Well, they were staying a little longer, I think.
Oh. Well, that's fortunate. Well, we'll tell you all the good places later. Won't you be seated? Well, we welcome you here, and have you received any materials about the case you're about to hear? There's material outside. Would you get some and then distribute as many as we have, if you would? It'll help you understand the arguments if you've got some information about what the facts are and maybe what the legal issues are. So our marshal is distributing that. We shall proceed to our argument. Well, let me introduce the court first. Starting on my far right is an empty chair, and that usually Diane Sykes is in there, Justice Sykes. She is not here today. Seated next to the empty chair is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Patience Rogensack. With the introductions made, we'll call 02-3353 FT, State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance Company versus Langridge. Mr. Devine, Attorney Devine, arguing for Nancy Langridge. We'll have 25 minutes. Michael, is it Reeses? Reeses, arguing for State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance Company, will have 30. And Mr. Devine will have an additional 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Devine.
Madam Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, my name is Tom Devine. I represent the defendant in this case and the appellant in this matter, Nancy Langridge. Ms. Langridge is the wife of a gentleman that died as a result of an automobile accident 3 years ago. And as a consequence of his death, there were claims that were made based upon his death on the State Farm policy. We are here to redress what I think is a conflict between the circuits concerning the kind of language that we have in the State Farm policy and how it ought to be applied in this circumstance. The issue presented to this court is to review this policy, which is an underinsured motorist policy, and the court has had occasion with many opportunities in the recent past to address this kind of issue. Underinsurance is clearly something that has become part of the pastiche of the of legal issues, and indeed in this particular matter, the language of the policy provides that Mrs. Langridge is an insured under the policy. She's entitled to coverage under the policy, and because she has coverage under the policy, she should be entitled to the benefits of that policy. It is unfortunate that both the trial court and the Court of Appeals didn't go to the language of the policy to begin its evaluation of what needed to be accomplished in this particular matter. The language of this policy is found in the record at 10, and it's a 57-page document that is including not only the liability coverage, but uninsured and underinsured coverage. The underinsured coverage is contained in the policy, and that policy is 30, or that coverage is 36 pages into the policy. The declaration page or the cover sheet of the policy provides that Mrs. Langridge is a named insured, along with her husband, and that the policy does provide underinsured motorist coverage of $100,000 per person and $300,000 per accident.
Mr. Devine, if I can interrupt for a minute, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that there was a conflict among the districts or between the districts of the Court of Appeals. Do you want to spotlight for us exactly what that conflict is?
The auto owner's case is an unpublished decision which provides that language in a policy, and this is at paragraph 12 of the auto owner's policy. They are looking at a Western policy, and the policy provides that we will pay compensatory damages which an insured is legally entitled to recover from the owner or operator of an uninsured motor vehicle because of bodily injury. In reviewing that language, the court determined that there was no requirement that the individual who was making the claim, the insured, in fact personally sustain physical injury to make that claim, because this language doesn't require that somebody be hurt in order to make the claim. The decision made by the Court of Appeals in our case, and also by the trial court, has our policy has very similar language that provides coverage at page 15 of 34 of the policy. The insurance language is, we will pay damages for bodily injury and insured is legally entitled to collect from the owner or driver of an underinsured motor vehicle. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals determined that there had to be some personal injury sustained by Nancy Langridge before she was entitled to get into the policy.
But what concerns me a little bit is when you talk about a conflict between the two districts, there's somewhat a different context for each of these cases. When I took a look at the auto owner's case, there we're talking about an uninsured motorist rather than an underinsured motorist situation. And at least the language that I think you're talking about in that unpublished opinion talks about the fact that the family's emotional distress claims constituted bodily injury. But there's no relation to any of the policy provisions or nothing that I could see in that statement that led me to conclude that they had carefully looked at the terms of the policy. And in fact, they went on to say, but it's tied to the son's injuries and death, and that can't be separated. So when I looked at that, I was troubled about whether there really was a conflict because of their language about how it's tied to the son's injuries and it can't be separated. What do you think that language meant?
Well, I think what they're talking about there are the kinds of concerns that have been expressed about where do you get access to the insurance policy for emotional distress, medical expenses that aren't involved in your own injury. Here, with respect to what we're talking about in this particular case, the conflict is that they decided on nearly identical language that you had to be hurt. You had to have sustained your own bodily injury in order to get access to the coverage that's promised at the beginning of the policy. When you read the auto owner's case, they read similar language and come to the conclusion, no, you don't have to be hurt. If you want to limit your opportunity to recover, you write it like auto owners wrote it. You don't write it like Western owed it. So the conflict is that in looking at nearly identical language, while under a slightly different circumstance, the court reviews that language and finds, no, you don't have to be personally hurt to get access to your policy. You have to look at the definition of what you're entitled to receive and then apply that definition. It's the identical definition that's present in the State Farm promise. They say you don't have to be hurt. All you have to do is have damages for bodily injury, and insured is legally entitled to collect from the owner. So it is the absence of that concept which is the problem between the two cases. Court of Appeals here decided a nearly similar language with nearly identical approaches to ensuring that under this policy, the State Farm policy, Nancy Langridge had to have sustained her own bodily injury to entitle her to coverage under a policy where she's an insured, and they've said you're entitled to underinsured coverage. This is part of a promise that we're making to you.
So what leads us to conclude, I know you'd like us to conclude this, what would lead us to your conclusion that the interpretation by District 3 is preferable to the interpretation by District 2? I mean, what is it about the language that leads you to that conclusion?
It's preferable because it's what the language says.
What specifically, sir?
Pardon?
What specifically?
When I
looked through the language of the policy, bodily injury talks about bodily injury to a person and sickness, disease, or death with results from it.
Right.
If I go to person, it means a human being.
Right.
But I didn't see anything one way or the other in that language that solved this problem for me. That shows me, for instance, that District 3 is right and District 2 is wrong. What is it that says, well, it's okay for a person not injured to recover for somebody else's bodily injury?
Oh, well, I think then you got to go back to the process that you're supposed to use when you evaluate insurance contracts. You got to look at the language and apply the language in a reasonable way. Auto owners tells us that when there isn't a condition of actual injury, you can't impose that condition on the right of the individual to obtain that insurance. You apply the language as written. You use the language to define what the rights of the parties are. In reviewing what that language is, you then decide, does the individual have a right to the coverage or not? Auto owners used that process to make a decision about how to apply for coverage. The problem in the case that we have here is that the Court of Appeals didn't do that at all. They never went to the language. They didn't look at it. They didn't review the language. They didn't compare it to what the process was. They didn't use any of the constructive techniques that are identified in auto owners or in the litany of cases that this Court has provided, where you go to the language, you look at the language, and you apply the language as written. So that's the difference here. Auto owners read the language, came to a reasonable conclusion about what the language meant, and now we have almost identical language here, and this Court of Appeals didn't do any review of the language and didn't make any evaluation of it, and now we have a conflict because we got very similar language in the auto owner's case being applied to say you don't have to be personally hurt, and our Court of Appeals in this particular case saying under the State Farm policy, before you ever get into it, you got to be hurt.
Are you concerned at all about the fact that the District 3 decision is an unpublished decision and therefore under our rules at this point is not precedent?
No, because when this Court is put in the oversight position and it wants to have justice provided to people in general, its responsibility is to look at the kind of activity that's taking place in all of the courts on all of the levels. We're entitled, or not entitled, but the Court should take a look at unpublished decisions and the reasoning and the background in an unpublished decision to ensure that the methodology that this Court believes ought to be applied is in fact applied. Citing to an unpublished decision doesn't change the impact of the fact that had we been in one district, you would have gotten one decision. You're in another district, you get another decision. It's that conflict between the way the decision-making process in the two districts is taking place that is being addressed in this particular appeal. This district, the one that we're dealing with in this case, needed to look at the language, needed to apply that language in the fashion that it was written. Auto Owners tells us that that's an appropriate methodology, and when applied to similar language, you reach this result. That's the conflict, and that's why it's important for this Court to address it. You don't want to have these conflicting processes out there taking place. You want to make sure that the appellate courts are using a process that's consistent and applied in a consistent way, because consistency clearly is something that's of benefit to all litigants and predictability.
Counselor, if I could ask you, do you believe that her claim is derivative of her husband's claim?
Legally derivative?
No.
No.
No. Why not?
Because the wrongful death claim is something that she may assert independently, and this individual had no right, having died, to assert his own claim.
Okay. So you think she has a separate and independent claim that you're proceeding on?
I do, but I'm not sure that that's really, with respect to how this language functions in this policy, derivative is a red herring. The idea, and it was addressed in Goucha, and it was addressed in Ritchie and Mullen, the concept is that if you're looking for these kinds of damages that arise out of, we're going back to the language of the policy to see what it provides for. If I got a single limit policy and I paid out my limit, my $100,000, I may not have the right to recover my wrongful death if my husband has already received all of the benefits that came from that, because it arose out of, and that's the concept that the Court has used to look at it. Derivative or not, on a legal level, I'm not sure is really what the focus was. You go back to the language of the policy and you look at what the language provided for, and the single limit said, I don't care how many people you got, I don't know how many people got hurt, if we've paid our limit here, we don't have to pay it to you again. That's the big distinction in the case that we have here. State Farm hasn't paid anything. They haven't paid a dime to any of their insureds. And yet they cite to the single limit Goucha and Ritchie process and suggest that somehow that limits their responsibility to pay to an insured that bought the policy.
Yeah, but I thought that they were trying to evaluate whether your client had a claim that was actually an underinsured claim.
That's an 11th hour position that's been taken. Had we actually gone to the language of the policy and addressed it in that fashion, absolutely we can discuss the concept of underinsured, the fact that Mrs. Langridge reads her policy, she sees that she's an insured, that she has a right to take underinsured coverage here, that her husband has suffered a bodily injury that she's legally entitled to recover from, and then if you want to get to the argument about whether or not this vehicle is underinsured, then the language that comes to play is that the vehicle has limits of liability for bodily injury which have been reduced by payments to persons other than the insured to less than the limits of liability of this coverage.
Well, what about subsection A? You read me subsection B, but doesn't subsection A apply? It looks like it's either one or the other.
It's a disjunctive. It's not a conjunctive.
Either one or the other.
I get one or the other. It isn't something where if one applies, the other one can't apply. It's a matter of process here. If I pay down my limits on a liability policy, if I pay those limits down to a point where they are less than the limits that are available under this State Farm policy, I'm entitled to coverage.
So what you're saying is that because they exhausted their limits on her husband, you fall under 2B.
Exactly. And then the question becomes the reading of how the reduction takes place. And at this point now, State Farm is suggesting, well, that somehow they're entitled to this, again, concept that she's got to be hurt in order to take advantage of payments that have been made, that somehow her bodily injury must occur, and she has to have the hurt, and she has to be the one that was involved in the accident for her to take advantage of this reduction. Why? It's nowhere in the policy. And that's why we go back to the original question that Justice Crooks put to us here. What's important? It's important to read the language to see you don't have to be hurt to assert the claim. You don't have to be somebody who was involved in this accident and actually had a physical injury before you're entitled to assert it. And then we begin the process of looking at the policy to see what does the policy tell us here. And we're told we're a named insured. We're told that we have $100,000 worth of coverage. And we read the language that's provided for the underinsured coverage here. And we're told we don't have to be hurt to assert our claim. And if the limits of liability of this other policy are paid down to somebody other than the insured, which for Mrs. Langridge is her, because she's an insured, and she says, I didn't get any money out of this. And that's clearly a reasonable and rational reading of what this language provides for. It's that reasonable and rational reading of the language that never took place in the Court of Appeals because they got short-circuited on this issue of, well, does she have to be hurt? And once they looked at Goucher and Ritchie and thought, well, she really has to be hurt before she ever gets into the policy, we never read the language. And that's where the difficulty in this particular case results. We are really going back to traditional views of reviewing insurance policies, of looking at language, of identifying ambiguities, of constructing the language to make sense, and then using the reasonable insured's understanding of it to provide an assessment. And if you... Justice?
This is just a man and wife. There are no children?
No children.
If there had been children, you'd be making two claims?
Well, I think everybody who would be involved would be entitled to make a claim. As we get beyond the issue of the coverage itself, and we get to the limit that's available here, would the children and the wife get separate limits? Are we going into the each accident issue? That's Goucher and Ritchie and Mullen, and I believe you've decided that these claims that are arising out of the bodily injury of the individual, and that the language that we have in the policy that says, I don't care how many people you got, I don't care how many policies you got, I don't care how many cars you got, if you got one person who got hurt, you get one limit. This case doesn't challenge that concept. This case isn't at issue with that concept. This case is saying before you can entitle yourself to that limit, you got to pay it. And here State Farm has never paid it. They haven't made a $100,000 payment to either the husband or the wife. And therefore, that concept of limit is really not part of what we're discussing here.
I'm not quite sure I understand.
We're
underinsured motorist coverage. If there were a child, there's the victim's wife and the victim's child. And there's one accident.
Right.
And it would seem to me, under your theory, the estate of the victim, the wife, and the child could each claim $100,000.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the single limit is not at issue in this case. Each of them can make claims against the policy. And even under Ritchie, the emotional distress claims were accepted as covered by the policy, but the insurance company had paid its limit. And it said, hey, I don't have to pay anymore.
So what's this limit here? $100,000?
$100,000.
And $300,000 per accident.
Exactly. And at issue in this particular case is just the $100,000 limit. And it's clear that the damages in this case exceed the $100,000 limit. I'm not here on the case where the wife and the children and all of these other people want to make claims and they want to expand the limit from per person to per accident. That's not what we're discussing in this particular case. We're focused in on the fact that I got one limit. It's $100,000.
Let me try once more.
Okay.
If you have the estate of the victim, correct me if I'm wrong, $150,000 has been paid to the estate of the victim.
Yes.
So there's payment on that.
Yes.
But you're saying that Mrs. Langridge,
yes,
does not have a derivative claim. It's an independent claim.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that within the context of what we're talking about here that that really makes much difference. But, yes, I believe she has a wrongful death claim that she can assert.
What I don't understand is why there wouldn't be at least two claims for $100,000 if there was a child under your theory.
There might be. But that's what we're looking at here would be, this is an underinsured policy. You have to have a right to make a claim under the policy. Whether or not the kids could make the claim, I don't know. I mean, I haven't really specifically looked at that. But Mrs. Langridge clearly has a right to make a claim against this policy. And then the issue becomes, all right, well, what do you do with the payment that's been made to her husband or to the estate for the pain and suffering that the husband sustained at $150,000? Does that mean that this vehicle is underinsured or not? And you go to the policy and you look at the language to see, all right, would that payment mean Mrs. Langridge can't make a claim here? So you have to remember that we're looking at a policy, and you got to fit into this policy, and the language needs to provide you an opportunity to recover on it. With respect to claims that I might make against Mr. Anhock here because he was negligent and the things that he did, I might have a litany of claims that I could make against him, but all of those people might not be able to take advantage of the underinsured policy that I have here, because you got to fit into the language of the policy, you got to be entitled to make the claim, you have to be an insured under the policy, and then you need to be able to look at this language to determine whether or not it gives you that right. State Farm wants to take advantage of the right because they say when you look at the word "the insured" in this reducing language contained in their definition of underinsured, it refers to any payment to any insured. And since Mr. Langridge got money here, you don't have coverage, Mrs. Langridge, even though you're a named insured, even though we made a promise to you that you would do it, even though you don't have to be hurt in the accident. And it's that conflict that exists in that sense of what do you do with this concept here, the insured.
Counselor, let me try to follow up on Justice Prosser's question a little
bit.
Let's just say that you had $200,000 of UIM coverage. Let's say the child isn't insured under the definition in the policy.
All right.
Does the child and Mrs. Langridge both have a claim of $100,000 each under UIM?
Well, the wrongful death claim would be a defined claim, and the right to recover under the wrongful death claim would be the survivor responsibility. The children are going to take under whatever the responsibility is under the
wrongful
death.
So you're saying there's no theory under which a child could make an independent claim?
Well, the children are, if they're minor children, they might have some rights here. The statute provides for a certain protection of minor children, but the statute's pretty clear about who gets to assert the claim.
Well, children assert claims in courts all the time. Often we appoint a guardian ad litem to look after their interests, but they still get to assert a claim.
Right.
And I guess what we're trying to get at is, I realize there's $100,000 worth of coverage here. I realize that the claim is for more than $100,000. So you can say, well, we have one claim and it fits within what's provided, but let's just say the coverage is $200,000. Can we take your reasoning and apply it to that policy, and where would we go?
Well, let's assume that I had two insureds under this policy.
Okay.
We then go back to Goucher, Ritchie, and Mullen, and we say, that decision's been made. If there's a limit on what I can get because I have language in my policy, which you folks have put the stamp of imprimatur on, that says if I put in it all the cars, all the people, whatever it is out there in the world, you only get one limit for this. And if it arises out of that bodily injury, then you get one limit. I don't care how many claims we made. Goucher and Ritchie tell us you got the one limit.
We're not communicating, and I don't know if, you know, I'm not just not asking the question well or what. But let me think about it a little bit more. Your time is up.
My time is up.
You on
yeah.
Thank you, sure. Counsel. You're going to be introduced by Wisconsin Attorney Kenneth E. Rush. Mr. Rush.
Justices, good afternoon. I am Kenneth Rush. We represent State Farm in this matter. The briefing and the admission by Mr. Reese's, he has done the briefing at the Court of Appeals. He is a member of our firm, and he will be presenting oral argument today.
A member of the Wisconsin Bar.
I'm sorry?
Is he a member of the Wisconsin Bar?
He is not. He is a member of our Chicago affiliate, and he has been admitted, I believe, pro hac vice in this matter and has been on the Court of Appeals on the brief.
Thank you. Welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you.
At least for a half hour.
Thank you, and may it please the Court, Counsel. Again, my name is Michael Reesus, and along with Mr. Kenneth Rush, I'm here today on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, State Farm. Now, the underinsured motor vehicle coverage, referred to as coverage W in the policy, is found in Section 3 at pages 15 through 19. And I want to say right off the bat that I agree with counsel that we do have to look at the policy language because the policy language governs everything there is in this case. And counsel is correct that under the insuring agreement, she is legally entitled to collect damages for her husband's death. But the policy also clearly and unequivocally requires that the bodily injury, which is a defined term, must be caused by an accident arising out of the operation, maintenance, or use of an underinsured motor vehicle. He read to you the first sentence of the insuring agreement. You have to read the second sentence of the agreement as well. Bodily injury is a defined term and appears throughout the policy in bold print. The policy defines bodily injury in 14 words as, quote, bodily injury to person and sickness, disease, or death which results from it, close quote. Now, the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals both correctly found that only the husband had sustained bodily injury as a result of the motorcycle accident. Nancy Langridge did not sustain her own bodily injury, sickness, disease, or death. At most, she sustained the damages that were derivative of her husband's bodily injury and not separate from or in addition to it. Now, how do we know this?
You then disagree with your opponent that you can bring a wrongful death action as a separate and independent claim, that it must be derivative?
I don't disagree that the wife could bring an independent cause of action for his wrongful death. That's what the law allows. But that's not what the issue is here. Instead, the issue here is how the policy treats the bodily injury claim, the bodily injury that her husband sustained.
Counsel?
And what? Yes.
Could you walk me through, again, the issue, at least as framed by your opposing counsel, is, in part, who does the bodily injury have to happen to? Or probably more precisely stated, does this language of the policy require that the plaintiff here be the one who sustained the bodily injury? So if you could point to the language that says it has to be the plaintiff.
And if you do that by identifying the page as you quote the language.
Yes,
well,
thank you.
Okay, the policy, let me be quite clear here. The policy does not require that the person bringing the claim sustain the bodily injury.
So okay. To that extent, you agree with your opposing counsel?
Yes, because, for example, if the other driver had bodily injury limits not of $150,000, but say had bodily injury limits of only $50,000, then her husband would have an underinsured motorist claim, and she could share in that recovery, even though she herself had not sustained a bodily injury, because when you go to the limits of liability section of the policy, which is found at page 17 of the policy or page 94 of the appendix, under the limits of liability, bodily injury to one person includes all injury and damage to others resulting from this bodily injury.
Counsel,
so what that's
counsel,
yes. Yes.
I'm sorry, for me you have to slow down.
Okay.
And what page were you referring to as you define bodily injury as it applies? Doesn't have to be to you but can be to others? You said appendix 90.
Well, that would be within the limit of liability section on page 17,
because when it talks about...
It's page 94 of your...
Right, page 94 of the appendix. It's page 94 of the appendix along the right column under limit of liability coverage W, that's the underinsured motor vehicle coverage. It stated that bodily injury to one person, okay, and that would be, in this case, the husband, because he's the one who died in the accident, he's the only one, includes all injury and damages to others resulting from this bodily injury. So to go back to a question that was asked earlier, her claim under the policy for her loss is derivative because it includes that damage to others, namely her, resulting from his bodily injury, in this case, his death. So SURG recovery is part, it's subsumed, as it were, it is encapsulated as part of his bodily injury. It is not separate and independent. It arises out of that bodily injury. But for that bodily injury, she would have no claim. Now, the way the State Farm policy works is State Farm agreed to pay up to $100,000 for bodily injury to any one person. That's the language on page 94 of the appendix to which I just referred. As a result of accident with an underinsured motor vehicle. The bodily injury must be caused by an underinsured motor vehicle. But from the standpoint of the policy, it doesn't matter whether the husband's estate or the surviving spouse collects from the at-fault driver, whether the estate is recovering for the decedent's conscious pain and suffering up until the time of death or for medical expenses, for example, or whether it's the surviving spouse who's recovering for her derivative damage as part of that bodily injury. Either way, as long as the total recovery from the at-fault driver is equal to or greater than the $100,000 bodily injury limit, there's no further recovery possible under the policy. Now, in this case, William Langridge was not involved in an accident with an underinsured motor vehicle when the at-fault motorist was insured for $150,000 and his estate recovered the entire limit of that policy. While he clearly sustained a bodily injury as defined in the policy, his wife did not. Again, she has no bodily injury, sickness, disease. Her claim is only derivative of his claim, his bodily injury. And as he was not involved in an accident with an underinsured motor vehicle, subject to that same $100,000 per person limit, neither derivatively was she. Now, just as the policy defines bodily injury, it also defines underinsured motor vehicle. That definition has two parts, as I think Justice Rogan-Sack had begun to refer to during the argument earlier. And that definition is found on page 15 of the policy or page 92 of the appendix. The first part of the definition, I don't think there's any question, is not at issue here. The first part of the definition is based on a comparison of the limits between the tortfeasor's policy and the stated limits of the underinsured motor vehicle coverage W. Here, the other driver was insured for liability for $150,000. That's greater than the limits of the underinsured motor vehicle coverage. So clearly, that part of the definition could not be satisfied in this case. I don't think counsel would dispute that. Now, where we do have a dispute concerns the second part of the definition. And what that provision states is that...
Counsel, just to interrupt for a minute.
Yes.
Are you at 2A and B now?
Yes. 2A and B on the right-hand side, on the right-hand side on page 92 of the appendix.
Thank you.
Where we have underinsured motor vehicle in bold print, and then underneath it's stated that under the second part of the definition that an underinsured vehicle includes a vehicle covered by an insurance policy whose limits have been reduced by payments to persons other than the insured to an amount less than the stated limits of the W coverage. Now, the payments the Liberty Mutual made in this case did not decrease its liability limits below the $100,000 limit of the State Farm underinsured motorist coverage, because all of the payments were made to the only person who sustained a bodily injury in the accident, namely William Langridge. Now, what the defendant is saying here
also,
is...
Let me ask you a question. Yes. Looking at that same provision, just say they were both on the motorcycle.
Yes.
Okay, and he got hurt and so did she.
Yes.
And he collected $150,000 from the tortfeasor's insurance. Are you going to pay her the $100,000 under this subprovision B?
Probably yes.
Okay,
because
why?
Because she has sustained a bodily injury, okay, caused by an underinsured motor vehicle that was underinsured as to her because all of the limits went to pay his claim.
Well, then I think if that's true, then you agree with opposing counsel that what makes the other vehicle underinsured is subsection B.
That would be the only section under which it could fall, but we disagree that that condition or that definition is satisfied in this case because the only person who sustained the bodily injury was William Langridge.
That's not what we're looking at. I mean, when this provision applies, if it applies to both of them on the bike or one of them on the bike, they got the same policy. So if you're going to pay her, if she's on the bike and she gets injured, it seems to me the vehicle is underinsured by policy definition. You don't change the policy definition by how many people are on the bike.
You might
change who's got a bodily injury. I'm not going there, but I want to just look at that provision.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but what you have to realize is that you can't look at that clause in isolation.
I can when I'm deciding if, in fact, there is even an underinsured motorist claim here. Because that's the first step. If I didn't think there was one, it doesn't matter whether she's got bodily injury or not to me. I got to find out, is there that kind of a claim available?
But to answer that question, whether there's an underinsured motor vehicle, you have to know who sustained the bodily injury and how many bodily injuries there are.
Well, you may run out of coverage. What I'm trying to figure out is just exactly what I said in my hypothetical.
Right.
And it seems to me the language says the same thing whether you got two people on the bike or one. And you tell me you'd pay her if they were both on the bike.
If they're both on the bike?
And they both got hurt. So therefore, there is an availability of an underinsured motorist claim. Now, maybe not for these circumstances.
That's right.
Okay.
And the reason for that is when you look at who sustained the injury, not in your hypothetical. In your hypothetical, she has sustained her own bodily injury. And that would satisfy every condition of the policy because...
I don't want to look at that.
Right.
But I was just trying to look at the
right.
sub B apply because that's where he's telling me the claim arises
but what
from.
But what you also have to realize is that when she is not on the bike and when she has not sustained her own bodily injury, the only bodily injury that's been sustained has been sustained by the husband, and her own damage is derivative of that, and since he is not, and since the other driver is not underinsured as to him, right, we know that from the definition, under A and B, it follows that there is no underinsured motorist claim as to her because the only person who sustained the bodily injury does not have the claim to make. It's not, the other driver is not underinsured as to him.
Well, that's a little different than I'm looking at. I understand what you're saying,
right.
But go ahead.
She's an insured, right?
She is a named insured, yes.
Where does she come in under the definition of insured, or doesn't it matter to you?
It matters in the sense that she can only recover one of two ways. First, she's on the bike. She sustained her own bodily injury. The payments that are used to pay his claim reduce the coverage so that below the stated limits of the $100,000 coverage, so that she has a claim in that situation. She would also have a claim if, for example, the other driver was only insured for, say, $50,000. She's not on the bike, but she's entitled to recover as part of his bodily injury because he has a bodily injury claim to make because, as to him, the other driver is underinsured because he only had 50 instead of 100. So she can recover in either of two different ways. Where she can't recover, however, is when she's not on the bike and when any claim she has is part of his claim and he doesn't have a claim because he got more from the other driver than they bought for themselves in underinsured motorist coverage in the first place. Now,
counsel, are you also in any way relying on the reducing clause? I'm looking at Appendix 94. You're not relying on it.
Well, let me say this. The reducing clause is not found on page 94.
Right.
The reducing clause that is in the policy actually appears on page 17. Okay. The clause that we're referring to on page 15, which is page 92 of the appendix, 2B, is simply the second way that you have the second prong of the underinsured motor vehicle definition. But it is not the reducing clause that's at issue in cases such as Dower or Badger Mutual versus Schmitz. We're not talking about that type of reducing clause. And what this court has said in such cases as Taylor versus Great Way Insurance or Smith versus Atlantic Mutual is that if the tortfeasor is not, if the other driver is not operating a vehicle that qualifies as an underinsured motor vehicle, the court will not move its analysis away from that definition to address the reducing clause. So with everything else going on in this case, the one thing that I hope I can say without fear of contradiction is we don't have to get to the reducing clause because you never have to move past the definition of underinsured motor vehicle. Earlier there was some mention made by opposing counsel as to the auto owners versus Western National case, an unpublished decision. And I wanted to say a couple of things about that. First of all, I don't believe that there is any conflict between that case and this case because, as Justice Crooks pointed out, it is a different context. That case involved uninsured motor vehicle coverage, not underinsured motor vehicle coverage that we have here. And actually, that decision relies on the same authorities on which we are relying by holding that the parent's claim for emotional distress arising out of the death of their 6-year-old son was still subject to the same per-person bodily injury claim, just as any claim that Nancy Langridge may have had for damages in this case is subject to that same single $100,000 bodily injury limit for her husband's death. There is no conflict. The cases are easily reconciled.
Also, I have to bring you back to that paragraph again in the
okay.
UIM. And I'm looking at page 92 of the appendix
of
my colleague's section 2B.
Yes.
You are relying on there being no coverage for her under sub B because the payments were made to the insured who was injured. Is that right?
To the insured who sustained the bodily injury, yes. And the only bodily injury.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Now, the person identified as an insured there is a the. It says the insured.
That's right.
Okay. It doesn't say an insured.
That's right.
Okay. I mean, if it said an insured, I'd understand what you're saying a little bit better. But it says to the insured. So the insured could be her, or the insured perhaps could be your husband. Because it doesn't say in there the insured
who sustained.
Go ahead.
I agree. If you just looked, if you knew nothing else about the case,
right.
If you knew nothing about the bodily injury, if you knew nothing about how many bodily injuries there were, if you knew nothing about how the bodily injury is defined, if you just looked at those three lines,
right.
I'd agree with you. All right? If you just look at those three lines in a vacuum without the context, it could refer to either insured.
But doesn't that make it kind of ambiguous if we don't know which one it refers to when we look at the provision?
But you have to put it in context. And when you put it in context, it is no longer ambiguous because it is clear that it can only be referring to the person who sustained the bodily injury. Why is that? Because she has no claim of her own, okay? Her only claim is part of his claim.
Yeah, I understand all that, but you know, if she were on the other side of this street and you were, this wasn't first party coverage, it was third party coverage, and she came in here saying that she's got a claim for wrongful death of her husband because your insured was driving a car that hit him, you'd pay that claim under the liability section.
Right.
All right. And you would pay it because she had a bodily injury.
Because she had a bodily injury, yes.
Right. Okay. So we got a bodily injury here, but you're telling me when it's UIM coverage, it's not good enough to be a bodily injury that's maybe her emotional pain and suffering for the loss of her husband. It has to be she broke an arm, broke a leg, or something like that.
Or he has to have a claim. Because,
I'm not worried about him. I'm just worried about her.
I know, but if he doesn't have a claim,
yeah.
Okay, because the money was paid out to him, clearly as to him, the other driver was not underinsured.
But see, that's why I have a trouble with paragraph B, because if it says this UIM coverage has been reduced by payments to persons other than the insured. Now, if you just said an insured, you'd catch anybody that was under the policy, and I wouldn't have a problem with your argument. But I'm having trouble not concluding that that's ambiguous when, you know, it doesn't include, obviously, every insured.
Maybe another way to look at it is to look at it this way. What counsel is trying to do is he's trying to split up the claim here.
So
that he has a claim and she has a claim. And he's trying to put her into subparagraph B as if she has a claim in the same way that he sustained a bodily injury. But when you look at how the policy defines bodily injury and how it treats her loss as being only derivative and included within all of the bodily injury to any one person, namely his bodily injury, if the other driver was not underinsured as to him, and we know that he wasn't
right,
then the other driver also wasn't underinsured as to her, because the policy doesn't really care whether or not whether the money was paid out to the estate, okay, or whether it's paid out to the surviving spouse for her loss of consortium. As soon as the total recovery is equal to or exceeds $100,000, the per person bodily injury limit, there's no further coverage possible because
see,
you only have one bodily injury here.
You go back to the case law that talks about per person, because that's where that
yes.
comes from. Right.
That would be Ritchie.
Right.
That would be the
right.
Gocha case. That would be the Mulhern case that just came down from the court last July. And in Ritchie, you know, it's interesting, towards the end, the Court of Appeals had referred to an ALR article which had come to the same conclusion, namely that it's all subsumed under the one bodily injury. And it's interesting that the court there says that, or it's referring to the court where it says it's been held that the different type of consequential or derivative injuries cannot be split up. You can't split them up to try to get a separate recovery above and beyond the one person bodily injury limit. And when you try to plug the person who does not have a bodily injury and is only entitled to collect derivative of the bodily injury into subparagraph 2B, you're doing just what the cases say you're not supposed to do, and that is split it up. And I think that's the problem with the argument here, is it's assuming that you can split these claims up in such a way that you almost equate her derivative claim, which is not a bodily injury, as if it were a bodily injury. I think that's where the problem is, and why I think that the result reached by the circuit court and the three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals is correct.
Counsel?
Yes.
Previously,
I think twice you were asked about the difference between the auto owner's case and the one that we have before us today, and you indicate, well, you know, one is underinsured and one is
uninsured.
Uninsured, thank you.
Yes.
And I say to myself, okay, that's a difference, but big deal. I mean, doesn't it all depend on the language? I don't care if it's underinsured or super underinsured.
And I agree with you. And let me just say this. Let me make it simple. If the other driver here, the drunk driver, if he was uninsured, we'd pay $100,000. We paid one limit. We pay it to him because, or his estate, because he had sustained the injury. And her recovery would be included as part of that single limit. And again,
okay,
we know that because of the definition.
So it's irrelevant.
Right.
It's irrelevant that auto owners might be dealing with an uninsured rather than underinsured. What is relevant is the language of the policies before us and the consistency of the language. Am I wrong or am I right? I mean, I just, you know, from the get-go, a couple of times that distinction was made, and I just don't.
But I guess I don't see where there's really a conflict, because ultimately, in auto owners, the court winds up reaching the conclusion that it's all that the parent's claim for the emotional distress is all included within that single limit. It's derivative.
There may or may not be a conflict. That's not the focus of my question,
right. Which
is, what difference does it make that one's an underinsured and one is an uninsured in and of itself? And I think your answer is no difference.
Doesn't make a difference. Language. Right. Doesn't make a difference.
Thank you.
In conclusion, we would suggest that the policy does say what it meant, and it did mean what it said, that the defendant's husband sustained the one and only bodily injury in this case because he was the one who was injured in the motorcycle accident, that the surviving spouse, Nancy Langridge, did not sustain her own bodily injury, sickness, or disease, that any recovery by her was subject to and derivative of that bodily injury, and that because the estate has already collected more in coverage from the at-fault driver than the stated limits of the State Farm coverage, that she has no underinsured motorist coverage to make, either as a personal representative or in her own right. We ask that you affirm the declaratory judgment entered below.
Before you fold those papers, counsel, a good part of your argument is focused on Appendix 94, Limits of Liability Coverage W.
Yes.
And bodily injury to one person. So I just want to go over that with you, if I may.
Yes.
Bodily injury to one person includes all injury and damages to others resulting from this bodily injury.
Yes.
Now, you are saying, as a result of that language, that makes it almost in and of itself a derivative claim?
That her claim has to be included as part of the bodily injury that the husband sustained in the accident. That it arises out of that fatality, and but for that fatality, there would be no injury or damage to her as the other in the others, you know, in that section. Yes.
Why can't you read that person? You're reading that person to be the husband, right?
Bodily injury to one person, yes. He's the one who was sustained bodily injury in the accident. She did not.
Isn't that circuitous? I mean, we're trying to define bodily injury, and the question is whether or not it has to be personal to her. And bodily injury to one person includes all injury.
That's right. So her injury is a consequence of and derivative of bodily of his bodily injury.
Do you have a definition of bodily injury?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That was the first thing that in the bodily injury definition. Just a moment.
I think it's on page 92. Is that the one you're talking about? The bodily injury must be caused by an accident? Is that what you're
referring to? I'm referring to actually, it's earlier in the policy under definitions. If we go back to page 3 at page 80, it's the first defined term on the left-hand side. Bodily injury means bodily injury.
That's why I think it's circuitous.
Well, it's tautological in the sense that bodily injury refers to bodily injury, but you have to understand the derivation is to distinguish it from, say, if it had said simply bodily injury means injury to a person. Then you could argue, injury to a person, that could be damage to, say, the marital relationship, which would be, say, loss of society or loss of consortium. And you would not have the requirement that there be a bodily injury. And you know what? If the policy had more broadly defined bodily injury to include injury and not bodily injury, she'd have her own claim.
Well, that was the point of my question. What is she suing for?
She is suing for his death, not for her own bodily injury, all right, and her claim for loss of consortium not being a separate bodily injury is subsumed as part of...
What are her claims? Is she suing for loss of society?
Yes.
Is she suing for mental anguish? I don't know what she's suing for. That's
she
why
would be
I asked
she,
you
right.
what bodily injury means.
She would be suing for any consequential loss from his death based upon her being a family member and the surviving spouse.
Emotional distress. You don't think emotional distress is bodily injury?
No, because I don't think it's I don't know that it's not a separate bodily injury. It may be one of those consequential damages that flow from his bodily injury, her bodily injury.
Is this a major difference between you and opposing counsel?
I think it is.
I do.
And I would say that I think it's been corrected, but if you look at the brief that was filed by opposing counsel in the Court of Appeals, I think inadvertently he had misquoted the definition of bodily injury by omitting the word bodily preceding injury to take advantage of the broader personal injury to the marital relationship, which this policy does not permit.
So it doesn't mean personal injury to a person?
Right.
In your view?
That's right. It means bodily injury defined as sickness, disease, or death which results from it. Well, bodily injury including, sickness,
disease.
It doesn't
say including. So if she'd gotten a scratch as a result of that accident, then she'd be fall under bodily injury.
If she had been riding on the back of the motorcycle and just got a bump and bruise, some compensable bodily injury, yes, she would. Which is different than simply a injury to the marital relationship.
Thank you.
Again, we ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Devine.
You can now see why our petition here asks that you take a look at this matter in the event you are addressing it from the perspective of the whole policy, that we now have implicated Folkman and we've implicated the process of contextual ambiguity and we're looking at the policy. I think that when you address this problem, and I apologize to Justice Rogensack, my colleague hit me upside the head here and gave me a better sense of what your question got to. There could be 3, 4, 5, 6 claims that evolve out of this accident. And under the process that we're talking about here, they would be entitled to use this policy to gain access to the limit that would be available to them. I'm coming at the problem because it's been raised here that the limits of liability section of this policy, which as far as I can tell has never been used to define what people can claim. It has been used to say you can't get more than this limit. But it has never been used to say your claim is only this.
Counsel, that concerns me also. And if I were just looking at 94 and I say limits of liability, what is he doing getting the definition of bodily injury and limits of liability? But, comma, going back to 92, I mean, there right after you define the coverage, we will pay damages for bodily injury.
Right.
Then there's the reference, there is no coverage until the limits of liability of all bodily injury, liability, blah, blah, blah. I mean, does this capitalized segment right after the coverage provision tie you into the limits of liability sufficiently?
No. The limits of liability that are being referenced in the definition for an underinsured motor vehicle have to do with the liability of the offending vehicle. Here, the next is the limits of liability for this policy. So when limits of liability are used in the definition process of underinsured motor vehicle, they are using limits of liability as in this case it was the Liberty Mutual policy, and you look at those limits and you say, well, do they meet or exceed what we're talking about? Then you don't have an underinsured vehicle. However, we do have a circumstance that we provide for when it's been paid down. And when it's been paid down, then those limits of liability that exist out there are what in fact exist at the time we make our claim. That's the process that is advanced in this case. So they provide for the process. They say, you can pay them down. You can have all of these events that happen out there. You can pay down your limits. And as long as it's as long as the payments were made to a person other than the insured, you develop an underinsured vehicle. When they hop to the limits of liability concept here, and they cite to these cases where this court has been addressing, well, where do these claims come from? They missed the boat. That's really not what we're talking about.
But, okay, so maybe you can't define bodily injury in limits of liability, but what about the definition of bodily injury on appendix page 80, which is bodily injury means
bodily injury
to a person and sickness, disease, or death,
sure,
which results from it.
I make reference to my third grade teacher, Miss Anderson, who taught me right away if I wanted to write a definition of something, I should not include the word I was defining in my definition because I create ambiguity. When you talk about what the bodily injury issue is here, the concept is, does she have to be hurt in order to make her claim? And that's conceded. She doesn't. She doesn't have to be hurt to make her claim. Her right to assert that claim is independent of being hurt in the accident. That's the issue that got drawn in the Court of Appeals, and it doesn't make any difference. She doesn't have to be hurt. She is entitled to make her claim as an insured, apply for the proceeds of the policy, use the policy opportunity based on their promise that they would give her $100,000 worth of coverage, and she is not the insured that has received the benefit of the payment of the Liberty Mutual policy. Why isn't she entitled to the reduction? There's nothing in this policy that you can read that straightforwardly tells an insured, well, you got to be hurt in order to use that reduction that you're talking about here and to apply it under these circumstances. If you're not hurt, if you don't have your own bodily injury, if you're not the one that was involved in the accident, then you don't get to take advantage of the reduction that we're providing. It's that absence of language that provides the difficulty in the case.
If this were the liability aspect, not uninsured or underinsured, could you recover from not hurt,
but you see the accident and you get
bone damage,
emotional distress.
All right.
Covered?
Are those damages covered under this policy? I think that the right of an insured to recover for bodily injury would mean that if the person were hurt, and that as a result of that hurt, somebody else had claims that evolved out of it. Yeah, because the concept of what you're entitled to receive doesn't mean that you have to be personally hurt by it. But that's not really an issue in this case. This issue specifically says you can recover for death. So clearly, she can make the claim. And she doesn't have to be hurt to do it. So when the bodily injury definition says, I get bodily injury, whatever that means, plus illness, sickness, and death, she has a right to recover for the death of her husband. She isn't insured in the policy.
What is she trying to recover for? I asked that of a
wrongful death.
Of her husband.
Of her husband.
Which includes what?
Well, pecuniary loss, the statutory loss of consortium amounts, and those are the two essential recoveries for wrongful death. Statutorily controlled, statutorily applied. I think that concept is pretty well described in the wrongful death statute.
Why isn't loss of consortium a derivative claim? Because
legally derivative?
Mm-hmm. Well, doesn't that make any difference?
I don't think that makes any difference. And I don't think it makes any difference here because limits of liability in all of the cases that we've been talking about has never been applied in a circumstance where the insurance company didn't pay its limit. It's never been used to deny people the coverage. It's only been used when I paid mom the money and she's dead. That's a single limit issue. I looked at the language. I don't get another limit to go to. I don't get to go to the per accident opportunity here. Didn't mean that I wasn't entitled to some of that money that came out, but the insurance company said I only pay $100,000. And that's the issue in this case. They haven't paid the amount, and yet they're using the limit of liability language, which has traditionally been applied in that fashion. Thanks.
I want to thank both counsel for yet another case before this court on underinsured motorist coverage. And that concludes our hearing on 02-3353-FT, State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance Company versus Nancy G. Langridge. The court is in recess until I think it's February 19th when we hear oral arguments again. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:20. We are adjourned for the moment.